sisters' needs and desires, and for their personal gain. This, according to the deviants, had been the prevalent philosophy among our ancestors for many millennia.
One, two, three, four, five, six!
Hi, this is Rodney Greenblatt from Catskill, and you're listening to WGXC ACRA 90.7 FM.
WGXC, radio for open ears. If you like what you're hearing, you know, WGXC has been really producing some excellent music programming, some entertaining satire, important local information. Become a sustaining supporter. Go to the website wgxc.org and click on that donate button. Help keep local hands-on community radio alive.
On Saturday, December 10th, the Athens Cultural Center puts on the 2022 Athens Victorian Stroll, a holiday tradition that's been gone for a few years because of the pandemic, but is back this year with all sorts of free activities from 1 p.m. in the afternoon through the evening. Take a stroll through the village, sample all sorts of food and drinks. Santa Claus will be around and carolers will be singing. That's at the 2022 Athens Victorian Stroll on Saturday, December 10th. Go to the WGXC community calendar online at wgxc.org for more information.
Do you have 17 cents a day to support a platform for many diverse voices to have their say on the local airwaves? Just 17 cents a day, a monthly $5 recurring donation, can help keep local youth on the air at WGXC 90.7 FM. Your monthly sustaining support will keep the airwaves full of music from around the world and around the corner. WGXC needs 500 sustaining supporters to make sure there is one spot on the dial where the community can have access to its own airwaves. Make your pledge today at wgxc.org/donate and do your part to protect an important source of local news, information, and entertainment. With just 17 cents a day, you will do your part to protect your favorite frequency. Become a sustaining supporter today. Go to wgxc.org/donate now.
WGXC is made possible in part by the generous ongoing support of Marcus DeGrazia Acupuncture of Austerlitz, New York. WGXC's sustaining supporters are among the station's most dedicated listeners. They care deeply about creative community radio, and their investment helps to sustain WGXC as a public platform for information, experimentation, and engagement in Greene and Columbia counties. Become a WGXC sustaining supporter today. Go to wgxc.org and click donate. Thank you for your support.
This is deprogramming from the Universal Media Network.
I'm Tom Rowe in the WGXC newsroom in Accra with the WGXC news update. Go to the WGXC newsroom at wgxc.org for more information about any of these stories. Andrea Macko in Porcupine Soup reports that on November 30th, Governor Kathy Hochul announced that construction has begun on the 339-mile underground Champlain-Hudson Power Express transmission line that will bring electricity from hydropower from Canada to New York City. Local communities get some of the money, and a risk of environmental accidents. Locally, the transmission line mostly runs along the CSX Railroad right-of-way and passes through Bethlehem, Ravenna, Queamans, New Baltimore, Coxsackie, and Catskill, and then into the Hudson River. While there are environmental risks locally, the project supplies 1,250 megawatts of clean energy to New York City, enough to power over 1 million homes. Hochul's office says that will reduce carbon emissions by 37 million metric tons statewide, the equivalent of taking over 500,000 cars off the road every year. The Greene County Industrial Development Agency awarded the project tax breaks, and the project will bring $15.7 million for Greene County, $3.1 million for the town of New Baltimore, $1.9 million for the town of Coxsackie, $1.7 million for the village of Coxsackie, $1.2 million for the town of Athens, $4.3 million for the town of Catskill, and $2.1 million for the village of Catskill. The Coxsackie-Athens Central School District would receive $29.5 million, while the Catskill Central School District is getting $27.5 million. The Riverkeeper Environmental Group is not enthused about the project. Quote, "This destructive project raises numerous concerns. There are better alternatives that have lesser impacts and far greater benefits. The CHPE project fails to meet the most basic requirement of a clean energy project because it will not directly reduce greenhouse gas emissions, and it will continue to emit greenhouse gases after 2040 when New York's climate law requires the electric grid to be emissions-free," unquote, a Riverkeeper statement says. Quote, "Adding insult to injury, this project would take up to billions of dollars in taxpayer subsidies that should be paid to a project that would reduce greenhouse gas emissions," unquote. Construction on the transmission line is expected to be complete in 2026. Read more about the story at Porcupine Soup. Mid-Hudson News reports that Dutchess County Legislature Chair Greg Pulver, a Republican from Pine Plains, says he will end his campaign for Dutchess County Executive if former State Senator Sue Cirino decides to run for the seat. Quote, "I absolutely endorse Sue Cirino," unquote, Pulver said of his fellow Republican. Quote, "She is a proven leader and a very respected across all of Dutchess County and is the only candidate that I would set aside my own run for," unquote. Cirino recently lost her Senate seat to Democrat Michelle Hinchey after redistricting pitted the two incumbents against each other. The Dutchess County executive seat is open because the incumbent, Mark Molinaro, was elected to the 19th Congressional District in this fall's voting. Cirino, so far, is unsure about running to lead the county. Quote, "Right now, after 8 years in the Senate, I am going to spend some time relaxing with family and friends," unquote, she said. Quote, "Several people have asked me to run for the seat, but it's too early to make that decision," unquote. Read more about this story at MidHudsonNews.com. Diane Valden reports in the Columbia paper that while the towns of Stockport, Canaan, and New Lebanon have all postponed their revaluations of property values to wait for an inflation reduction, Ankrum town board members voted November 17th to move ahead with their revaluation. Quote, "I don't see it. In my opinion, by holding off a year, you may not see a difference," unquote, "between doing the reval in 2023 or waiting until 2024, said Columbia County Real Property Tax Service Agency Director Suzette Boy. Ankrum Town Assessor Renee DeLue favored postponing the reevaluations. Quote, "Let's wait till 2024 and see what the market does," unquote, DeLue said. Councilmember Amy Gold said she has heard worries from constituents about the recent higher-than-normal sales prices and, quote, "they fear their taxes will go through the roof," unquote. Supervisor Art Basson, Councilmembers David Boyce, Hugh Clark, and Bonnie Hunt voted yes to hold the 2023 reval as scheduled, while Councilmember Gold voted no. Read more about this story in the Columbia paper. And read more about any of these stories in the WGXC newsroom at wgxc.org.
For the Daily Yonder and Public News Service, this is the news from rural America. Idaho trout is world famous, but more fish of all kinds these days are grown on commercial fish farms, which come with environmental costs. A group called Salmon Safe created a label 2 decades ago to identify farms that ban pesticides and keep fish manure out of waterways. They've just awarded the first-ever trout-safe certification to a farm outside Ketchum owned by the Nature Conservancy. Neil Crescente is a manager.
It's really important, not just to the health of the species themselves, but also to the economy.
Crescente says many farms are eager to obtain the eco-labeling to attract savvy consumers. The shortage of housing units for rent or sale across the country is close to 4 million. But even existing homes aren't necessarily healthy to live in. The Rural Local Initiative Support Corporation, or Rural LISC, has launched an initiative to improve housing conditions. Xander Brown has more.
Extreme changes in temperature, known as thermal stress, or old paint and carbon monoxide poisoning, are just some of the risks that lead to health issues. Through the Healthy Housing Initiative, 22 rural organizations received $20,000 each to support rehabilitation projects, as well as new construction in their communities. Here's Tim Klont, Director of Housing with Rural ISC.
Housing stock in many rural communities is aging and in need of repair, which can contribute to unhealthy living conditions in many places.
Whether it's pest infestations, structural weaknesses, or other defects, Klotz says harmful conditions can have very serious effects on childhood education and learning, on top of the potential stress of relocation.
If a home is not stable, affordable, and healthy enough for a family to stay in, then they're constantly moving.
I'm Xander Brown.
In Oklahoma, work is underway to make it easier for people who want to move to rural areas to find available land. The state's Home Builders Association, along with the Municipal League, have teamed up to create a new database showing what's out there.
It is a good way, I think, to attract developers who don't really know the terrain out in rural America.
Shantaria Charleston is with the Housing Assistance Council, a national nonprofit that supports affordable housing efforts throughout rural America. The database includes other useful details, like the cost of purchase or local utilities.
Lots of times people don't even know who owns land. And so if there is any kind of contention over the property, having this information would be really helpful.
There were 60 listings in the database last month, Charleston says, which could eventually provide some folks with a path towards sustainable home ownership. For the Daily Yonder and Public News Service, I'm Roz Brown. For more rural stories, visit dailyyonder.com.
Qatar's World Cup is a lavish exercise in sports washing. I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! With Dennis Moynihan in our weekly Breaking the Sound Barrier podcast. Regardless of whether one calls it soccer or football, the FIFA Men's World Cup tournament underway in Qatar may be the most watched sporting event ever. It's predicted by the time the month-long tournament ends on December 18th, half the world's population will have tuned in. 1 million fans are expected in this small, scorching desert peninsula in the Persian Gulf to watch teams from 32 nations compete. Since FIFA awarded Qatar the games back in 2010 in a process suffused with corruption and bribery, planning and construction has occurred at a frantic pace. 7 massive new stadiums, a metro system, new roads, 100 hotels, over 100 practice fields, and more have been built, almost exclusively by migrant laborers who work in Qatar with virtually no rights. The torturous, extraordinarily hot working conditions endured by workers are believed to have caused thousands of deaths. Abdullah Alarian, history professor at Georgetown University in Qatar, said on the Democracy Now! NewsHour,
in terms of what football has represented historically in the region, of course, this goes back to the colonial days when it was being introduced by British and French officials as a way of kind of instilling discipline and kind of civilizing the local populations.
Qatar's treatment of foreign workers is another consequence of colonialism. Professor Alarian explains.
The kafala system, which there's been a lot of discussion around, was the kind of migrant labor governance structure. This was something that was put in place initially by British colonial authorities at a time when they were trying to preserve their own interests, as they were recognizing the fact that, you know, in the process of trying to secure their economic interest in the form of the oil sector and gas sector, or in terms of maintaining security, in terms of their presence, that they wanted to tie all of the migrant workers to their sponsorship, meaning that their employer would dictate the extent to which they would be allowed in the country for how long. And so things like changing jobs were not permitted without the permission of the employer. There was no real protection over things like a minimum wage or even safety considerations. And so this was a system that was then inherited by all of the independent states in the Gulf.
While in Qatar covering COP18, that year's United Nations Climate Summit, Democracy Now! Interviewed Devendra Dungana, a Nepalese journalist investigating working conditions for migrant workers from Nepal. World Cup construction had just begun.
We visited the labor camps, and what we saw was just unbelievable. Now, more than 15 migrant workers living in the 12 to 14 rooms with very little facilities. No running water, no AC in several places. They are living in very squalid conditions. 50 people sharing one small kitchen, and there's no fire extinguisher service there, no running water, and 50 people have to queue up in the morning to use one toilet. What we expect to see is more people will die of working in the stadiums than the number of players playing in the Qatari stadiums.
Geopolitics have also impacted the games. Qatar is an absolute monarchy. Like many dictatorships around the world, it enjoys the full backing of the U.S. government. CENTCOM, the U.S. military central command, has its forward headquarters just miles outside of Doha. It's the largest U.S. military base in the Middle East and only about 150 miles from Iran. A U.S. soccer team's social media post depicted the Iranian flag without the emblem of the Islamic Republic to show solidarity with women protesters in Iran. Iran responded by demanding the U.S. be ejected from the World Cup. Meanwhile, the Iranian team itself took a courageous stand, refusing to sing their national anthem, ostensibly in solidarity with the protesters back home. The international athletes and tourists flooding Qatar have also come into direct conflict with the ruling monarchy's deep-seated intolerance. Homosexuality is illegal in Qatar. On the eve of the games, FIFA banned One Love rainbow armbands that several teams were promising to wear to express solidarity with the LGBTQ plus community.
We're definitely seeing sports washing, where political leaders are using the sports event to try to deflect attention from human rights.
That's Jules Boykoff, a former U.S. Olympic and professional soccer player, speaking on Democracy Now!
FIFA should act and put some of its money where its mouth is and give some money to migrant workers and their families who haven't been paid properly. Some of them have died and they haven't received proper compensation. So if you win the World Cup, you get your team gets $42 million. That should be the bare minimum that should be then thrown in the direction of these families who have suffered so greatly because of the World Cup that is giving so many people around the world so much joy.
In a recent op-ed on the World Cup published in the New York Times, Professor Abdullah Alarian quoted Palestinian poet Mahmoud Darwish, who wrote, "Soccer is the field of expression permitted by secret understanding between ruler and ruled in the prison cell of Arab democracy," he said. Soccer is called the beautiful game, but the 2022 World Cup should serve as a reminder that for many in the world, the fight for human rights, workers' rights, and equality is not a game. It's deadly serious. I'm Amy Goodman with Dennis Moynihan.
I'm Tom Rowe in Acre with the WGXC Renewable Weather Forecast for Sunday, December 4th. We start each renewable weather forecast with the price of fossil fuels in Greene County. $3.69 a gallon is the lowest price at the Citgo in South Caro, according to the Gas Buddy website. Then we look at the air quality forecast, which is a 23, up slightly from yesterday, but still in the good range. Meanwhile, the water temperature in Albany in the Hudson River is 50.51 degrees Fahrenheit, 10.28 Celsius. And the average Hudson River temperature on December 3rd over the last 10 years is slightly lower than that, so it's slightly warmer than usual right now. The National Weather Service in Albany says Sunday should be mostly sunny with a high of 37 and a northwest wind 5 to 9 miles per hour spinning local windmills. Sunday night should be mostly clear with a low around 23. And then Monday, the forecast is for sunny skies again with a high of 44 and a south wind 6 to 9 miles per hour. Monday night, there's a 50% chance of rain or snow showers, depending on the temperature, with a low around 32 expected. And then Tuesday, showers are again in the forecast. There's an 80% chance with a high of 46 and a low around 42. You're listening to the radio, WGXC 90.7 FM, Acre, Catskill, Hudson, solar-powered radio for open ears.
We're joined by Natasha Panica, who is the executive director of Food Pantries for the Capital District. And, you know, while we all tend to pay a little bit more attention to the issue of hunger during the holiday seasons, hunger, unfortunately, is a 365-day-a-year problem. And there was a recent article that highlighted some of the growing demands for supplemental food, emergency food in the Capital District, particularly as the various relief programs on COVID begin to run out. So Natasha, what has been happening at the food pantries throughout the Capital District?
Great. Thanks, Mark. And thanks for inviting me on for this important conversation. You know, during the pandemic, there were a lot of federal assistance programs, state programs stepping in to help people who were struggling. And those child tax credits have ended. The SNAP increases, honestly, at this point are irrelevant because of inflation. And there are so many people struggling to make ends meet now that really never have before. While at the same time, food pantries are also struggling to keep up with needs. You know, inflation is not just impacting individuals, but nonprofit organizations are also struggling with the increased prices in gas, food, and all of the other impacts of inflation as well. So what we are seeing in the capital region in New York is that 80% of the food pantries in our coalition of 70 are experiencing increased levels. When we recently surveyed them, 50% of our food pantry coalition members are really worried about having enough financial resources to make ends meet through the end of this busy holiday season.
Now, one of the issues is most food pantries rely very heavily on volunteers, and a lot of the volunteers are elderly. And I imagine they may have been a little bit reluctant, especially during the early days of COVID, to be getting out in the public. Has that changed as COVID become more normalized? Or I assume you still always need more volunteers?
Yeah, I mean, we can use volunteers. The volunteers that are most needed in the food pantry system are regular volunteers who dedicate, you know, once a week, once a month, like regular people who actually perform like a task, an operational task. Some of the things that we are in need of now are people to do the home deliveries of pantry groceries. Resources for home delivery has really dried up, and kind of going back pre-pandemic to relying on volunteers to do that. One of the struggles is we're really trying to increase access to food pantry services and transportation, and people with, you know, disabilities who are not able to access a pantry in person really need that delivery service. So, you know, we want to be able to provide a consistent service, which helps when you have paid staff to do it. But if there are people out there who would like to dedicate time ongoing to do volunteer work, the other thing that I really is tough is most people don't realize that most of the food that pantries distribute, they actually pay for. And a pantry's dollar goes a lot farther than you if you want to do a food drive. Like, food drives are great, but pantries also need money. And so if you're doing okay right now and you can donate to food pantries, you can find a local pantry throughout the state of New York on our map, thefoodpantries.org. We have a food pantry map. So if you want to help your neighborhood pantry, you can find one on there. Or you can help the food pantries for the Capital District, which helps a coalition of 70 food pantries as well. The money makes a direct impact to helping over 50,000 people get enough food for more than 2 million meals every year. It's very needed.
Can you talk maybe a little bit about the demographics of who, you know, you're, you know, feeding? I know in the past that, you know, maybe half of the guests, you know, at least getting food, you know, were children, but there was also a pretty high percentage of the working poor. People have jobs, not making enough meat. Has that been changing over time?
You know, there are a lot of people who are working who just aren't making enough money and rely on food pantries. I was actually doing a presentation recently for a company talking about our organization, and the administrative assistant came up to me after the presentation and said, you know, Natasha, thank you so much for raising awareness. She's like, since inflation, I actually have to use a food pantry to make ends meet too. And she was like, thank you so much for the work that you do in the community. And I, you know, whenever people say, Natasha, how do we end hunger? Number one, it's living wages. People are falling so far behind in wages. If you are an employer or someone in a decision-making opinion, please, please focus on living wages for your employees.
Now, you mentioned earlier the SNAP program, used to be known more as the food stamp program. But, you know, are there things that the anti-hunger programs are looking to the state, federal, or even, I guess, county governments to be stepping up the plate on in terms of trying to deal with hunger and helping people with food?
Yeah, I mean, New York State is really ahead of the game as far as coordinating all of the different state agencies, along with the nonprofit partners that are really trying to work on solutions for a hunger-free New York. You know, we've got a lot of work to go, and it's really hard to, you know, push on the federal government. I think that, honestly, we have federal solutions that work, that if the federal government would just increase SNAP benefits, increase access to SNAP, I feel that we should mandate that any online grocery should be able to accept SNAP and WIC. And anyone who purchases groceries using SNAP and WIC online should have supplemental provided by the federal government to provide free home delivery. I think that right there is the most dignified way to end hunger. It's because people can have choice in the groceries, and you take away the access problem. But while we're waiting and pushing on federal government to make important changes, we have to make sure that people don't go hungry tonight. And that's why food pantries are so important. And we need to make sure that their shelves are stocked with a variety and quantity of nutritious food to help people make ends meet in the meantime.
Quickly review some of the other services that the food pantries of the Capital District provide. Looking quickly at your website, I think you also had some programs particularly trying to target like infants and young children.
Sure. We are a part of the National Diaper Bank Network. We provide free formula and diapers through our coalition of food pantries. We also work with groups to do personal hygiene products, feminine hygiene products, and we have a food as medicine program as we're working on sustainable funding through Medicaid for people who are struggling with diabetes, obesity, hypertension, to prescribe medically tailored meals and medically tailored groceries along with nutritional counseling and therapy. So, we're looking at a lot of different ways to help people. And, you know, SNAP doesn't cover diapers and personal hygiene products. And so those items are expensive as well. So distributing them through the food pantry system can also help people.
Now, you mentioned earlier that, you know, obviously people appreciate volunteers on Thanksgiving and Christmas, but the reality is you're looking for volunteers, you know, on an ongoing regular basis. So in the last minute, you know, if people want to help out either by volunteering or make a donation, how best to get in contact with their local food pantries?
Yeah, the best way is to go to our website. It's thefoodpantries.org. They can get involved through our website locally here in the Capital Region of New York, but we also have a map on our website that has food pantries and community meal programs across the entire state. So no matter where you live in New York, we've got resources that you can find. The other thing is, if you are struggling right now and could really use some extra help, know that food pantries are not income-based, they're need-based. So if you make $10 a month too much to qualify for SNAP, you can still get assistance from a food pantry. So go to thefoodpantries.org to find resources, or also if you're doing okay right now and can help our community, we really, really appreciate it.
Well, thank you very much, Natasha Panica of Food Pantries of the Capital District. And this has been Mark Dunley for the Hudson Mohawk Magazine.
Next, we're going to tune in Scanner's RF Radiation from his 1995 album Spore. The British artist known as Scanner is Robin Rimbaud, whose early controversial work used found mobile phone conversations. This track is from his second album and includes a sample of someone warning about the dangers of mobile phone radio waves.